Hello and welcome back to a fascinating story that includes war, famine, smuggling, everything was there. So if you missed it, you can catch it on dubaieye.com/IonCareers and check the podcasts. As well, if you are looking to get an edge in your career or your business, doesn't matter who you are, from the chai wallet to the CEO, we run a free event called The Executive Mindset, and we have a stellar CXO panel on the event, which includes Ziad Makazumi, the former CFO of ArabTech and the current chief executive officer of Faki IVF, a fertility clinic, the leading fertility clinic in the GCC, actually. Anna Sadek, the office managing partner for Deloitte in the MENA region. And Kashif Rana, the group chief financial officer for Aqua Power. And Mukhtar Hassan, the Chief Executive Officer of Al Barij International. These guys are going to be talking about how to drive peak performance in your career and in your organization. It's a free event on November 30th. That's Sunday, November 30th from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. at the Canadian University of Dubai. That's the Canadian University of Dubai in the Red Theater. So please come out and join us. We'll be there if you have any questions or, you know, things just aren't going exactly as planned in your career. We can definitely help you out with that. Again, I also want to thank our sponsor, the ICAEW. That's the Institute of Chartered Accountants of England and Wales. They really have a commitment to driving that leadership dialogue in the community and contributing to the bedrock of professionalism here in the region. And they allow us to bring you these executive business leaders and their messages and their lessons learned on the road to the top week after week. But now we have a very special person here in the studio with us whose story started back in 1964, when her mother came here as one of the only female doctors with a specialism in gynecology, and ended up delivering most of the babies in the region, and was the leading female doctors, and eventually grew into one of the most successful healthcare groups here in the region, which is Zulika Hospital. That was Dr. Zulika Dowd, and her daughter is here with us, Zenobia Shams, who is now the chief executive officer of Zulika Hospitals, a leading healthcare group. It was founded in 1993, and its presence includes primary and secondary care, diagnostics, clinics, tertiary care, hospitals, pharmacies, educational institutes, and clinical research trials. Zenobia, welcome to Eye on Careers.
Thank you so much, Ian. I'm glad I could finally make it here. You know, Shane and I have been planning a rendezvous for a long time.
Yes.
I'm happy to know that I was able to come here and that the second time has proved to be lucky for me. So thank you, Shane, for having me here.
Yes, you found us. You found us all right. So that is very excellent that you're here. But it's such a touching story because, you know, when you look at your story, it's not like your mother came here and said, "Oh, I'm gonna build this huge healthcare enterprise." It was more like, "What can I do to contribute to the community? How can I, you know, make a value-added contribution?" And I find that so often a theme when you look at the real top performers, they're more interested in the opportunity to contribute to the fabric of the healthcare industry, or to contribute, you know, to the dot-com movement, or to contribute to Einstein, for example. He didn't care about being a Nobel Prize laureate. In fact, he wanted to contribute to physics. And when you look at the people who are average performers, they're so focused with the obligation. You know, what's my job? What's my job scope? Can you give me your job description? You know, and I don't know if you find this theme echoed as well in your own experiences as a chief executive officer.
Well, you know, the best workers, I mean, and I don't want to use workers in the context of manager or executive or whatever, but the best workers are those that are the most open and receptive to ideas. taking opportunities, exploring opportunities, saying, okay, I'm going to do this. And then it doesn't matter what that job is. You know, they'll become managers, they'll be executives, but they'll become managers. They won't necessarily know finance, but they'll make it their business to know how the numbers work out. So, you know, they're comprehensive managers. They look at the figures, they look at ops, they do the whole bundle, and they want to learn and they want to do more. And yes, they will occasionally trip up, but if you see that person, you don't have to focus on the fact that they're tripping up. You have to focus. I mean, as a senior manager, I have to focus on what is this person willing to do, what his or her key strengths are. And one of the greatest strengths is ambition. Ambition and ability. And the mistakes, if you're going to hire people, they're going to make mistakes. If you're going to let people do things, they're going to blunder along the way. You can focus on the blunder or you can focus on the potential.
And I think one of the things also you mentioned there is they want to learn. And, you know, we always look, you know, in executive search when we're doing a search or an assessment is what I call intellectual curiosity. Are they really interested in building a better mousetrap? Are they really interested in figuring out the latest industry trends or latest information? And the average performer wants to know just the bare minimum they need to do their job. And this is also one of the differentiators, I find. I don't know if you would agree.
Yeah, absolutely. The willingness to do more, to learn more, and the willingness to do more comes from the willingness to learn. You know, you can't have, you know, like they say, you can't have power without responsibility. And so if you want more authority, you need to know how to get that extra authority. And authority, one of the key components of authority is respect. You know, you're getting respect from your fellow worker. And if you're in a leadership position, then you're in that leadership position because those who follow you believe you're going to lead them on the right path, broadly speaking. Yes, there's mistake X versus mistake Y, but put that aside and say, you know, am I the person you're going to follow? Are you going to follow me? If I am that person, not because I've been imposed upon you, but because you genuinely believe that where I'm going is the place where you want to go also. You believe in my vision. You believe in my capacity to take you there, mistakes notwithstanding. So that's a critical component. I always look for that X factor in a person.
The vision, I consider it kind of like a boat, right? And what I think, though, is the only person who's really focused on where the boat is going is the captain. If you look at these cruise ships, most of the people, they don't actually care about the destination. They're more concerned about what's the cabin look like and, you know, what's the actual boat like. And there's very few people that are really critically focused on, you know, those two or three visionaries on the boat who are really there to go and check out the next island or whatever it is. And I don't know if that analogy draws on business, that, you know, most of the people are looking at, you know, what's the amenities that the organization's actually offering. And there's very few people that are really into, hey, where is this organization going? Can I come along for the ride?
So here's the interesting thing, Shane. People don't, yes, there are people who are not focused on the end point. There are people who are focused on the end point. They're in an organization, there are people who are only interested in the amenities and the utilities, like you say, and not very focused on where are we really going? Where is our career going? Where is my career going to go in this group? So, but everybody doesn't have to do the same thing. You know, as an organization increases in size, people need to do different things. Everybody will not be an ace performer. You need to create an atmosphere where the ace performers come out on top, but that there's always a lot of place for the B performers, not the visionaries, not the leaders, but the true worker bees, the guys who carry and the gals who carry the heavy load. And they're not to be diminished. I know now there's a lot of thinking in HR and in human resource development about, you know, the top segment and get rid of the rest and only keep the top. But this is not possible. I mean, it's you can say it, but actually an organization is not made up of stars. It's made up of worker bees. And worker bees take you from place A to place B. Do they take you from A to Z? Possibly not. But they are the people who get you from A to B and so on and so forth until you get from Y to Z.
There's some new theories coming out now where they actually, some people are saying, you know, leadership is totally overrated and unnecessarily raised up on a pedestal, because without your first few followers are those worker bees who choose not to be the tip of the spear, but rather, you know, they're choosing to support that first tip, are the ones who actually change history. You know, when you look at it, actually more and more evidence comes out. You know, for example, the letter that Einstein wrote to do the atom bomb, that was mostly created and suggested by one of his first few students. So it wasn't actually Einstein's idea itself, but one of his first few followers that pushed that across the line. So I don't know if you're also, I mean, it sounds like you're putting more of an emphasis on what you call the worker bee versus the strategic visionary.
Everybody can't be a strategic visionary. You know, everybody can't have a vision, otherwise we'll have clashing visions. So there has to be one visionary or two visionaries, and the rest of the people need to carry the load. Actually, I don't exaggerate. I diminish the importance of visionaries, but I don't also want to diminish the role of the worker bee. And what it is that it's an intricate, what's the word for it? It's an intricate blanket of sorts. And that it combines the visionary with the worker bee, and where there's a worker bee today who could be a visionary tomorrow, because circumstances change, the environment changes, and the same person that's been, you know, pushing along and doing things in a routine suddenly has a spark and does more, or never does more, but you know, is satisfied to just do that little bit.
But I think when you actually look at the region, I mean, does it not just beg the question that perhaps the strategic visionary is the jargon of the academic, the business academic, but the actual business practitioner, success rests on strong tactics, you know? And in fact, we started the discussion by saying, your mother was, you know, I think, you know, almost like a Mother Teresa type of figure in the region, but it wasn't this huge vision that I'm going to go to the Middle East and I'm going to, you know, make these milestones in healthcare. It's like, no, where do you need a doctor? Okay, 8 hours in the middle of the desert by four, you know, in the middle of the night. Okay, fine, I'll do it. You need a doctor, I'm going to go do it. And it's tactically and consistently delivering. And I think when you look at a lot of the millionaires and even billionaires in the region, you very rarely find this strategic genius. What you generally find is a hardcore tactical excellence at the root of that business. I don't know if you agree or disagree with that statement.
I agree, and I think I'm agreeing with the right thing, because I'm not an academician, so there's a lot of big words that you use in there, Shane. But I'm going to give you a story here. My mother started her career at the age of 25, so she's a fresh graduate, just out of medical school. It's 1964. She's delivered her first child. He's 8 months old. She leaves him in India and she comes to the UAE. Well, it's not the UAE at that time. She comes to the Trucial States and she works for the Kuwait Mission Hospital. Now, for 20 years, she's an obstetrician. And what does that mean? What does that mean? That means that you go to work when the sun rises and you come home when the sun sets, literally. She once told me the story. She says that for 20 years, she never saw the sunset.
Wow. Not a day off.
Not a day off. 20 years. I mean, and you know,
how do you not have a day off?
Well, you know, I mean, it's like I say, it's not for everybody to do. And amazing. I think there's some hint of, you know, the visionary that you're going to turn out to be, or as my brother always says, the blood and guts individual that you are. But 20 years on, she does this. So she's in her mid-40s. The rules and the regulations change in the UAE, and she can't do just plain simple deliveries anymore in her clinic. So the regulations change.
I just have to stop you there before we go into, because I can see this is a really exciting story. So we're going to hear the story of how Dr. Zulika Daud became Dr. Zulika Daud in just a minute, right from the source, her own daughter, Zenobia Shams, the chief executive officer of Zuleika Hospital. So stay with us. This is going to be amazing.
Dubai Eye 103.8. Stay one step ahead.
Hello and welcome back to Eye on Careers. I'm your host, Shane Phillips. And I just wanted to let you know of a great free event called the Executive Mindset that's happening on November 30th from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. We are going to have some of the top CEOs and CFOs talking about how to drive peak performance in your career and in your organization. We have Ziad Makazumi, the Chief Executive Officer of Faki IVF, the leading fertility clinic in the GCC, and also he was former Chief Financial Officer of ArabTech. We also have Anna Sadek, the Office Managing Partner for Deloitte in the MENA region. We have Kashif Rana, the Group CFO for Aqua Power, and Mukhtar Hassan, the Chief Executive Officer of Al Barij International, one of the leading Omani private equity firms, talking about how to get that edge you need. It's free, and it's at the Canadian University of Dubai in the Red Theater, Sunday, November 30th, 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. If you have any questions about your career, you can ask us then. As well, this is an interactive show, so if you have a question, you can SMS us at 4001, that's 4001, or use our mobile app, which you can download on ionCareers1038.com. We are now listening to one of the epic stories of how Dr. Zuleika Daud became Dr. Zuleika Daud. And her daughter is here, Zenobia Shams, who's the chief executive officer of Zuleika Hospitals. Welcome back, Zenobia.
Thank you, Shane.
We just have a quick question from the audience. They're asking, if I want to start my own business, should I work part-time and run the business simultaneously, or should I just go gangbusters and just do the business on its own?
Okay, so I'll take this question and I'll answer it in two parts. What is your financial requirement and what is your capacity to work are the two questions that I need to ask you. Because if you need that extra revenue to come in and you're getting that from working part-time and you need that to, you know, support yourself, support your family, or even support your business, then yes, you should think about it. If, on the other hand, you can manage your financial affairs without working part-time, then my suggestion would be, if you're serious and keen about your business, then you should focus on it full-time. Because when you work on something else, you know, you do divert your attention. There's only an X amount of energy we have in a day. And you say, well, I can do this and I can do this and I can do this, but you can only do one thing, both physically and intellectually. So, you know, if the business you're going to do is your passion and your interest and you intend for it to be an important thing in your life, then you do need to focus on that full time.
Focus is the key. And as you were just telling us the story of your mother, I don't think anyone could be more focused than that. So basically where you left off, she was working 7 days a week for 20 years as an obstetrician.
Essentially, she was on call all the time. You know, babies don't take permission and come out. They're not, it's not a thing that works out like, you know, I'm ready to come next week. Can you put me into your, book
schedule
between lunch with your best friend and dinner with your mother? I'll be coming in at 7:30 p.m.
Send the Outlook invite.
Yes. So no, it's not like that. It's, I'm here.
Right.
And they come before and they come after. And a lot of times, you know, I think one of the critical components of her success, other than her capacity to work hard, was her involvement in the community. She knew people. She wanted to know people. And she wanted people to know her. You know, she didn't want to be somebody who sat on the corner and was not available. She wanted to be available and she wanted everybody to know, yes, I'm here and I'm a part of your community. I'm a part of your family. And it had to do with the fact that she could respond and integrate, you know, so many different views, visions, feelings into who she was as a person. You know, if you came and told her that, and this is true about her even today, you know, she'll be walking. She goes for a walk every morning. She'll meet strangers on the beach and she'll talk to them. And I'm like, Mom, what are you doing? And she's like, you know, no, you know what? This girl, she came from Afghanistan 2 months ago and, you know, she's a refugee. I'm like, Mom, you're talking to strangers. Don't do that. You know, it could be anybody. It could be like, you know, She's like,
she's an iron lady, though. I know. I was with her one day from 6 a.m. to 11 p.m. working on a media project, and she was standing to the last minute, and I think she had more endurance than people, the 20-year-olds working on the set. So it was absolutely amazing. Of course, she was featured in that TV show Top Guns, and is a Top Gun Hall of Famer and has accolades. You know, I think she's one of the most famous healthcare people in the region. So, but you were telling us, how does she make the jump from being the obstetrician into...
So you know, obstetrics is a high-octane specialty. It's a little bit like being in the army and being like black ops or something. And then after that, they put you to a desk job. So then she, you know, and then she shifted from that to having a clinic. And a clinic was just not to her taste at all. You know, you went in at 9 o'clock in the morning, you came home at 1, and then you had a long lunch, and then you slept for 4 hours, and then you went back to work at 5. And remember, we're talking about the UAE at the time when people worked the split shift, which is 4 hours in the morning. There was a big fat siesta in the middle, and then you worked in the evening. She didn't want to do that. She was bored. She was bored out of her mind. And then what happened was, through a chance meeting with the ruler of Sharjah, and it was a chance meeting, you know, he
How
says...
How do you have a chance meeting with the ruler? Like, you're walking down the street, and you're like, oh, Your Highness... Actually, that could happen in this region, actually, because they are actually pretty. Is that? But that's not what happened. Like,
no,
how did
that
it
isn't. But that's not the. So through a chance meeting with him, you know, he says, you know, we're really happy with all the things you've done for Sharjah, and Mom says, in a nutshell, I'm really happy that I was here, and I wouldn't have been this. You know, I wouldn't have been the person I am without Sharjah. So. We're kind of, I mean, I, so, and she always says this, that she sees her story as integrated with the story of Sharjah and broadly speaking of the United Arab Emirates. And she says, you know, you cannot tell my story without telling the story of the UAE. So anyway, he says, you know, I mean, and there, so she's in a majlis and, you know.
What year is this?
And this is 1990.
Okay.
And he says, well, you know, you've done, you know, we're happy with your contribution to Sharjah and what can we do for you? And I think he was not expecting her to say anything, but she said, I want to open a hospital. I want to start a hospital. And there's an interesting history there. In the early 70s, she, the government of Sharjah very generously gave her a piece of land, you know, and the idea was that she would build a hospital on that. But at that time, you know, from I think a lack of vision or courage or I don't know, whatever you want to call it, whatever deficiency there was at that time, she didn't build a hospital. So forward to 1990 and he says, what do you want? And she says, I want to build a hospital. And he says, okay. And he writes her a letter. This is the ruler of Sharjah, His Highness Sheikh Sultan bin Muhammad Al-Qasmi, writes her a letter saying that, you know, addressing it to the Ministry of Health, saying, you know, help this lady with whatever she wants. And she takes that letter to the ministry. And remember, she's bored out of her mind. There's no obstetrics. There's no octane in her life. Children are grown up. She's in her late 40s. She's bored. Very, very bored. And she goes, she takes this letter, she buys a piece of land, and she builds a hospital. But not this hospital. The hospital
I
is
love
five.
How you make it so simple. Like, she baked a cake. Like, she went, she had a land, she
made a
hospital.
Mean, you know, and you I want to make this sound more complicated than it was, than it is. But this is how simple it was, because this is how simple she makes everything in her life seem. You know, my mother is... And here's an important thing that I think everybody who's out there wanting to start their business or wanting to look for a job or whatever it, or, you know, get ahead in their career. And I think one of the important things you have to look at is, are you going to be a problem solver or not? If you're a problem solver, every organization is going to want you. And if you're not a problem solver, if you're a person who's overwhelmed by problems, whatever that level of problems may be, then you're not going to be appreciated in an organization.
It's not only that the people who are overwhelmed by the problems aren't the worst ones. The people that are excited by problems and are problem aggregators and sit around and go, "Oh, look, this why this can't happen and this is why that can't happen." And they bring you this big thing and it's like, go solve the problem. Yeah, why are you bringing this to me?
Because they can't. That's what I'm trying to tell you. They're overwhelmed by the problem. Whether, you know, it's being presented to you this way or it's like a pie or a cake. The thing is, the problem is still there. So whether you make a big deal out of the problem or just don't address the problem, one way or the other, as far as the organization is concerned or as far as your life is concerned, the problem is still there. So you're... And with my mother, one of her great skills is she's a high-level problem solver, you know. And I was speaking to somebody the other day, and they were saying, look, you know, there's low-lying fruit. And there's, you know, I mean, you look at a tree, right, a fruit tree. There's the fruit that's low, and then as you have to reach higher and higher up to get more and more fruit. So after you're done with the low-lying fruit, you need to raise higher. You need to, you know, improve your game. You need to do more if you need to keep getting that fruit that's right up on top. Now, if you're the kind, I mean, if you're looking at a salary of 5,000 or 10,000 or 12,000 or 15,000 dirhams per month, you know, that's basically in terms of fruit picking, that's you're going from the lowest fruit to higher, higher, higher. By the time you come to, you know, let's say 35K a month or 40K a month or 45K or 50K, you're really getting right up there to the top of the fruit, of the tree. And are you going to be the person that can get up there? Because if you're overwhelmed by the problems and if you're like, oh my God, this problem is just too big for me, I can't even imagine how difficult this is, then you're not going to get to, the companies are not going to pay you.
You're going nowhere with that attitude.
Exactly. So, like I said, with mom, and you talk to her sometimes, you know, and she says, yeah, you know, we did this, then we did this, then I started a hospital, then I bought this land, then we built a bigger hospital. Then we went to Dubai and we built another hospital there. And the way she says it, it's like, just like this, in this tone. So you never really comprehend that there was like this phenomenon. And if you weren't there, like I was, and you didn't see it all, and you didn't, and now I can't believe that even from the time I was a little girl, and I remember that she used to get up in the middle of the night and go and attend deliveries. You know, when I was 10 or 11 years old, I remember that. To this time now, she's 75. It's a 50-year career, and it's had multiple components to it. But what there never has been in her life has been a time when she sat in the corner. You know, the other day, I have to tell you something funny. I was talking to my brother, and my brother is he's an oncologist, and he works in San Francisco at the University of California. At San Francisco, and he picked up the phone, and I think I didn't get the time right, so it was like relatively early in the morning, and I think he was asleep. So I asked him, you know, hi, are you asleep? And he's like, no, I just woke up. And I was teasing him. I was like, you know, if this were mom, she would be like, you went to sleep? You went to sleep without curing cancer? How did you go to sleep without curing cancer? Get up, go out there and cure cancer right now.
This is Zenobia Shams, the Chief Executive Officer of Zuleika Hospitals, giving us her insights to driving or creating what it takes to succeed in the healthcare business. Apparently, you're not allowed to sleep. But coming up, Asma Bajawa, the founder of People First HR Consultancy, a leading HR consultancy in the GCC, will be joining us, and we'll be talking about how to drive peak performance in your career and in your organization. And we're also having a free live event on November 30th from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. at the Canadian University of Dubai in the Red Theater with some star CEOs and CFOs like Ziad Makazumi, the Chief Executive Officer of Faki IVF, the Fertility Clinic, Anna Sadek, the Office Managing Partner for Deloitte in the MENA region, Kashif Rana, Group CFO for Aqua Power, Mukhtar Hassan, the CEO of Al Barij International. This is all happening November 30th, 7 p.m., Canadian University of Dubai in the Red Theater. Coming up, we're going to hear more from Zenobia Shams and Asma Bajawa, how to drive peak performance. So stay with us.
Dubai Eye 103.8, keeping you up to date with what matters in the UAE. Stay one step ahead.
Hello and welcome back to Eye on Careers. I'm your host, Shane Phillips. And we were just hearing the amazing story of Dr. Zulika Dowd, who is one of the iconic healthcare figures here and the founder of Zulika Hospitals. And here to tell her story was Zenobia Shams, the chief executive officer of Zulika Hospitals. And she's still here now to talk a bit more about peak performance in the organization. Zenobia, welcome back to Eye on Careers.
Thank you, Shane.
So you have 1,200 staff under you.
Yes.
That is quite a large team. And to also pepper the conversation with a little bit of spices, Asma Boudjawa, the founder of People First HR Consultancy, a leading HR consultancy in the GCC. Welcome to Eye on Careers, Asma.
Thank you very much. Good evening.
And you have had an exciting career as well, servicing clients such as DO and the Abu Dhabi Airport Authority.
Right across the region, actually. We work with large and small organizations. I think our largest client is about 30,000 people, and our smallest client is probably about 5 people. So we work across industry sectors, across the region, and it's really exciting.
And so one of the tough questions is, how do you get, especially if you have 30,000 people, or you have 1,000 people plus, how do you get these people all marching to the beat of the same drummer? And not only that, but marching as fast as they can. Zenobia, what are some of your approaches, and what's the toolkit that a leader can use to drive peak performance in an organization?
I think to focus on performance is very important, to kind of reiterate what the point is. There's a point. I mean, there's a point. There's a reason you're coming to work every day. And I think as a leader, and I don't like to use the word leader too much, because it kind of, makes me sound like Bismarck, but I'm not, I hope. But where are we all going? And it's important to keep stressing on the end point. There's an end point, or there's a direction, and you need to keep dwelling on that. That's one. The other very important thing is empowering people. If I hire you, Shane, tomorrow, one of the things I have to do is let you do your work and not treat you like a secretary. You're a highly paid executive. You're coming here with a skill set. You've been hired for a reason. You're being paid what you're being paid for a reason. If I'm going to micromanage what you do, what I really need is a secretary who I will give detailed instructions to, and then that secretary will go and do what I ask him or her to do. I don't need that. I need you to do what you need to do the way you know how to do it best. And you are doing that with a set of skills that you have that I don't have. And I need to appreciate that you have that skill set and that you know how to implement that skill set in the service of our mutually accepted end goal. So that's at a senior level. So that's at my level. Now, that I would imagine and I would hope would permeate down the organization. That's how you treat those who report to you, and so on and so forth. And so we kind of have that whole attitude permeating through the organization. But everybody has a management style, and every management style has the potential to be effective. And this is my management style, but Asma can have her management style, and you can have yours, as long as we're achieving what needs to be achieved.
So your approach is more of an organic cultural ethos that drives a certain type of behavior, but it's not really locked down with, say, operational audits or balanced scorecards or...
No, it has all those things. It has all those things. And those are, all the ways by which we make sure that end goals are being met. I can say anything. I can say I want to conquer the moon tomorrow. But if we don't have a plan by which we're going to conquer the moon, we're not going to get there. So it's critical that we utilize all the methodologies that you've mentioned. We use some, we don't use some. We believe in some, we don't believe in some. But these are management tools, and they're there to make your life easier. and they're there to make sure that you have a plan that you believe is going to get you where you want to
so
go.
So what are some of your favorite levers? I mean, you're being pretty vague, like we use some, we don't use others.
Okay, I'll tell
like
you what.
What do you think are really the key things when you say, I'm going to drive peak performance in this organization, here's the five key things I need besides the ethos and cultures of autonomy and letting people do what they do?
We do budgets. We do annual budgets. We do quarterly reviews. We do operational audits. So we talk about, where have we reached in the first 3 months? Where do we need to go in the next 3 months? Where do we see ourselves, before the year ends? And every department kind of does this review, whether it's finance or whether it's operations or whether it's HR or whether it's admin. That's basically broadly our biggest departments. And then there are our clinical departments. And we use a lot of clinical evaluation tools. We do evaluations for doctors. We do evaluations for nurses. We use other statistics by which to measure capacity utilization. That's a big thing for us. When we build capacity, one of the ways we evaluate how effectively we're doing what we need to do is by looking at capacity utilization, how well we're utilizing our IP facilities, how well we're utilizing our operation theaters. So we do a lot of capacity utilization methods that we use. And then we, from there, evaluate, why are we not getting where we need to go to?
So Asma, do you think that, we've created the right toolkit here? Because on one hand, you find organizations saying, we want teamwork, but we reward individual performance. We want innovation, but we're tied to tradition and we punish failure. What in your mind, where do you feel we're on in terms of this journey, in terms of maximizing that human factor in a business? And in your opinion, what are some of the more cutting edge toolkits that leaders have at their disposal in the 21st century?
I think Zenobia's touched on a number of those. I think it's important to understand and really think out what you want out of a performance management system, for example. I think, in summary, there's three top things that we should be looking at. Is really, how do you align your people in an organisation to your objectives? So that alignment that you just mentioned, Zenobia. Really, how do you maximise potential to achieve your objectives? That's the first thing. Secondly, how do you identify talent and then develop talent through those kinds of measures? And last but not least, and sometimes people forget this, is how do you support and manage poor performance? Because there are people in the organisations that aren't achieving perhaps the expected standards. So those three things I think are important to set in the background. On top of that, I think in terms of cutting edge, leading up, I like to keep things fairly simple. They have to be fit for purpose, first of all. You've got to look at an organisation. You've got to see whether individual objectives or team objectives, what are the roles that you're looking at? So there's a time and a place, and you've got to really evaluate, if you look at individual doctors versus if you look at further down in the organisation, it's important to recognise the type of roles that you're looking at, recognising how each of those roles contribute to the overall strategy and objectives, and really develop a framework that is fit for purpose. I think keeping it simple and easy to implement is one of the tricks, though. We go into a lot of organizations where if it becomes too complex, it won't get done. If people see it as something else on top of my day job, it's not going to happen. So how you embed those practices into the way we do things around here, that's the, I think, one of the important factors. What other enablers are there that can help you? If you have a system in place, the system shouldn't tie your hands behind your back. It should help you get to where. So the system should be customized to a process as opposed to you customizing necessarily the other way around. So educating and training people is an important aspect that we sometimes forget about when we develop very robust frameworks that have leading edge calibration processes and rating scales, etc. But if we forget to tell people how to use the framework, how to sit down and have a conversation with people in terms of giving them regular feedback, monitoring that performance, as Zanubia has just mentioned, about reviewing regularly, those are some of the things that are really important to keep it simple and keep it real for people that will help the implementation process.
What are some of the biggest mistakes people use or that commit when they're using the, you know, or trying to utilize these performance management systems or to drive talent management in organization? And of course, leaving out the bottom of the barrel, the ones who just don't have anything, but, you know, kind of those B players who are struggling to get this and they get it wrong. What, in your experience, are some of the follies you see, common follies?
I think one of the most common things that I've seen that contributes to that is the performance management process becomes an end of year sort of milestone. It becomes it's now the end of the year, we've got to suddenly complete this process and have we done the reviews? And people quite often even forget to have the conversations, to actually sit down, make time to speak to individuals, to thank them for what they've done, to congratulate them for their achievements, to talk about them and give them honest feedback on things that they did well and things perhaps that they could do differently. So people don't spend enough time on having those kinds of conversations. Quite often I conduct audits in organizations where people haven't even had the conversation. A checklist would have been filled out by the manager. The employee won't even have participated in that process. And yet the other extreme, there are some organizations that may have put robust self-evaluation processes in place, but really sort of not leaving it in your bottom drawer until the end of the year when you think, oh my God, I've now got my performance review, I've got to pull out my objectives and remind myself and sort of shake off the dust. Really, this should stay with you throughout the year. We should be monitoring this on a regular basis. Our framework, our process should encourage that so that, you know, we help people achieve those as opposed to realize that we've missed something when we get to the end of the year.
This is Asma Bajawa, the founder of People First HR Consultancy, one of the leading HR consultancies in the GCC, and Zanubia Shams of the iconic Zulika Hospitals. She's the chief executive officer there and the daughter of the famous Dr. Zulika Dowd. They're going to come back in just a minute talking more about driving peak performance in your career and in your organization. So stay with us.
Dubai i 103.8, award-winning news, business, sport, and lifestyle coverage. Stay one step ahead.
Hello and welcome back to Eye on Careers. I'm your host, Shane Phillips. And fireworks are going off here in the studio, and we almost couldn't get our guests back online. Zanubia Shams, the Chief Executive Officer of Zulika Hospitals. Welcome back.
Thank you, Shane.
And Asma Bajawa, the founder of People First HR Consultancy. Welcome
Hi.
Back.
Thank you.
And so I guess what we're talking about is the 360-degree review is a sham. Is that, who's are quiet now? Come
well,
on.
There's the Shams, that's me, and there's the Sham, that's something else. So we're not talking about the same thing, right, Shane?
No, you're saying
two different things here.
No, but what we were talking about driving peak performance in your organization, and you were saying what a bunch of smoke and mirrors, window dressing it is when people are saying, "Oh yes, we have an emotionally intelligent organization, and we do the 360-degree review," and you were saying that what a farce that is, because I'm not going to give my boss an accurate 360 review.
I think you need a boss who very, very clearly empowers their staff and makes their staff feel comfortable. Is confident enough? Is confident enough and is empowered enough to empower his or her staff? Those are two critical things. And I think 8 out of 10 bosses are not that.
Yeah, right. I think also with the 360, there's always a fear of repercussion. So it's really about how is that information going to be used? So that people are fearful, you know, giving feedback to their bosses. But as we were saying in the break, that, you know, how you ask the question, if you simplify it and say, you know, I would ask my team, tell me two things that I do well and one thing you want me to do differently. So that doesn't mean that, you know, they have to be fearful of to saying, well, if you spent more time telling us what the strategy of the organisation was or spent more time coaching us, that, you know, that's a negative thing. It's really about creating, you know, an environment where people feel that if I say this, it's not going to have any repercussions in a negative way. And secondly, that information is going to be used positively and create an environment where that kind of feedback is welcome. If, of course, you're fearful and, you know, I think here it's very complex with the mix of cultures, that, you know, if you give feedback to someone in a more senior position, that's going to be used against you, or your next promotion won't happen, or you won't get your increment, then, of course, that will make people fearful.
Right, right. But at the end of the day, though, these 360 reviews, it's almost like nobody's really going to 100%, as Zunubi, you said, give the full meal deal on, you know, I think you're a pain to work with, for example. I can't say that if I'm your... The CEO, for example, gets a 360 from the COO and the CFO, and, you know, they're not going to throw the guy under the bus.
No,
because it's a suicide.
My view, Shane, would be that you structure the 360 questionnaire that says, okay, tell me about my leadership style, or tell me whether I communicate the objectives to you regularly. Do I sit down and have regular reviews with you? So you help people, rather than leave it open and tell me that I'm, you know, no good at my job, you actually focus the feedback and through questionnaires and through formatting it in such a way that says, do I sit with you regularly to review your performance, yes or no? Do I coach you when things get tough, for example? So I think by pulling together a format which allows people then to be specific on the competencies that you want feedback on, rather than saying you're crap at your job, or that, you know, enables that conversation to happen in a better way.
But isn't it as well really should be the role of an external consultant to come in and do that 360? It should not be done by the staff themselves. You scratch my back, I scratch yours. Exactly what Zunubia says.
I think, look, at the end of the day, the 360 degree review has a point. The point is to know people. So to this end, I do agree with Asma that you do need to develop emotional intelligence and, of course, intellectual intelligence also about your staff, what they're doing, what they're good at, are they having personal problems. Now, I don't know if Nurse X sitting in outpatient department Y, what she's going through. But, you know, she has a line manager, and that line manager needs to know, and that line manager needs to tell their line manager so that we have a good understanding of who's going to stay, who's not going to stay, what their troubles are, what they need from us, what we need from them, and can they indeed give us what we need from them. And I think at the heart of 360 degree, or the heart of any review, any HR review, I don't know if Asma will agree or not with me, lies the discovery of that.
Yeah.
But that fundamental
we're running tight on time, so let's just get to a question I want to ask. How do you ask your boss for a raise? And
with a smile on your face.
So both of you are bosses, and so in your opinion, out of all the people who've tried to get you to give them raises, which ones were the most effective in less than 40 seconds each?
for me, it's those that come with the evidence to support what they've delivered in terms of what they were expected to deliver. Those that can demonstrate that they're, you know, they warrant that. Those also that have taken into consideration that it's time for a review and haven't come mid-year saying, well, I now feel like I need to have a... So these kind of, you know, increments should be set with regular review periods, maybe once a year. So if somebody has a conversation out of turn in that, that isn't perhaps going to engage me. But if somebody sits down and says, look, I've now delivered what you expected of me, this is what I've done, etc., is it now time for us to talk about the salary?
Yes, all of the things that Asma has mentioned, I think all of those clearly indicate that, yes, those are the people that need to get a raise. Also, one of the things I do want to say to everybody out there who's working or who's looking for a job or who's looking to get ahead is, you know, look at what your organization or your boss is going to gain from you. Once you figure that out, you are going to get where you want, whether you get it from this organization or another organization. You know, if you can monetize and understand clearly what your boss is going to get, he can understand, you can understand clearly what you're going to get from your boss. If it's not clear to your boss what he's getting from you.
So to quickly sum up, you know, Asma is saying, as a business owner, you have so many balls in the air. You can't always keep top of mind what one performer's wins are. So bringing that to the table and articulating my value, what some of my big contributions have been. And secondly, aligning your personal compensation growth with the value add and the overall wealth creation that's being created by the organization, and creating that alignment. Hey, listen, if you give me XYZ, I can help you deliver ABC. Is that kind of, I summed it up in 10 seconds?
Yes.
Obviously, it's a bit deeper. We just don't have time to go. But I want to thank you both so much. I wish we had more time, because you guys are just getting going here. So we'll have to have you both on again, and it's always a pleasure. So thank you so much, Zenobia, for coming.
Thank you,
on.
Shane. Thank you, Asma. It was a pleasure meeting you.
Thank you.
And
thank you.
Thanks, Asma.
Thank you, Shane.
So that was Zenobia Shams, the Chief Executive Officer of Zuleika Hospitals, and Asma Bajawa, the founder of People First HR Consultancy, one of the leading HR consultancies in the GCC. If you missed any of that, you can catch the podcast on DubaiI1038.com/iOnCareers. As well, we're having an event on November the 30th from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. It's a free event and is a star-studded event with a panel of consisting of Ziad Makazumi, the Chief Executive Officer of Faki IVF and former CFO of Arabtech, the largest publicly traded construction group in the Middle East, Anna Sadek, the Office Managing Partner for Deloitte MENA Region, it's with the largest audit firm in the Middle East, Kashif Rana, the Group CFO for Aqua Power, Mukhtar Hassan, the Chief Executive Officer of Al Barij International, one of the leading private equity groups in the region. They'll be talking about how to drive peak performance. We have a few people saying, you know, they may not be able to come right at 7. That's fine. Come whenever you want. It's from 7 to 9 p.m. And it's at the Canadian University of Dubai in the Red Theater. That's on Sunday, November 30th at 7 p.m. You can also go to the Executive Mindset on meetup.com and join the group and get some updates on exactly all our events that we do. We do about 2 free events on the ground every month to help people get that edge and move your career to the next level. So that's it for this episode of Eye on Careers. I'm your host, Shane Phillips, saying make the rest of your life the best of your life.